we have to attract people still. We're not the only place in the world that highly skilled that needs people and needs highly skilled people. And we have to retain people, right? We can't have newcomers come here with these skills and we invest and they invest so much time and then they leave, you know. And one of the things I pointed out on this panel is that
welcome back to the Newcomers Podcast, people, where I explore what it means to be an immigrant with immigrants like myself. Today's a really, 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 really exciting conversation for me. Because I have with me Jonathan Oldman, who moved from the UK to Canada some while back now. But I think that's not, for me, like, that's not even the big thing for me. It's actually, he's the CEO of ISS of BC, which is one of the biggest immigrant serving organizations in BC, that's British Columbia, and they've done some amazing work. But we'll probably talk a bit about the work they've done. But I think the big part of the conversation is really how do we have a better conversation about Canadian immigration? Because it feels like the past 18 months has just been all over the place. And I think I'll kind of kick start off with you, which is, if you've been here for a bit, and so it feels like you've seen Canadian immigration in different phases, what does this moment feel like, honestly? Like, if you reflect back on your time here so far and the work, and because you work in the sector, what does this moment feel like?
Well, first of all, Desi, thanks so much for inviting me to be part of your awesome podcast. It's a great contribution to our sector, to the community, to our country. So it's really wonderful to be here. I've been in Canada for 26 years now, and I've worked in the immigration sector for less than 5 years. I've always worked in the not-for-profit social impact sector, call it what you will. And so I'm still really learning about the experience of newcomers to this country. But it's also really helped me reflect on my experience as a newcomer. I came as under a temporary work permit, and then I became a PR, then I got my citizenship. And honestly, for many years, I didn't really think of myself as an immigrant. I didn't think of my identity wrapped up as an immigrant. And working in our sector and talking with and working with immigrants and newcomers every day has really helped me reflect on that and reflect on the experience of what it's like to be a newcomer, what it is like when you come through different streams from different places and different journeys. As I often say to people, you know, I look and I sound a certain way, and I recognize the privilege of that and how it changed the way that people looked at me. They didn't look at me as an immigrant or a newcomer. I seemed to fit in. It didn't seem to be, people didn't focus on my difference or what my experience was in my home country and was it relevant. There was a sort of a naturalness to it. And I have reflected on that privilege. And also then for people who come from, whose experience and journeys are very different, how they may have the same skills, the same experience, greater determination as me, but they haven't had the same experience. And so how I reflect on where things are at today, if I extrapolate that, it's kind of as if immigration was not a hot button issue for many years. There was a greater consensus on it. You know, issues came up, debates came up, but now we're in this place of really heightened scrutiny, heightened debate about what it means to be in a country that is immigrant-based, immigrant-focused, what it means to have countries around us that have got such different attitudes, not just to immigration, but to multiculturalism, identity, belonging, And so suddenly all of these things are converged today. And it's kind of interesting because I joined the immigration sector 4 or 5 years ago, and those debates weren't so present, but they are now. And it's kind of paralleled my journey of understanding a bit more about the experience of newcomers and immigrants to this country.
Yeah, it's, I mean, first of all, I really appreciate you saying that. Like, that is, like, I really appreciate that. Because, you know, there's that thing of where, I remember when I interviewed someone, he doesn't live in Canada though. I think he's living in like 13 countries or something. They said, Dozie, I'm a world citizen. And I found that interesting. I was like, I agree with you. But on reflection, I didn't say this to him. And if I listen to this, Ben, like, this is no shade or anything. But I was talking to someone about it, and this person said to me, I'm a world citizen too. I've traveled, I've lived across different places like him. But the only difference between me and him is just simply that he probably can blend in much more than I can blend in. So I will always, no matter where I go, I mean, I will always have to defend being an immigrant. For him, it's like, oh, he'll say, I'm a world citizen because I can live in different countries. And that's so interesting, which is why I really like the story you used to close out your standing remarks at the House of Commons, which is the Ibrahim story about where he says, I left everything behind, but I believed Canada could be a place where I could build life again. And I think that's the beauty of Canada, which is why it's sometimes sad to see the things, the conversation we are having. Because Canada is that place where you just kind of feel like you, no matter what, you're welcome here and you can build your life here again.
Yeah, it's interesting how, I suppose, many of us have, well, it's easy to lose touch with our journeys beyond the short term. And, you know, that very obvious and important point that unless you're someone who's Indigenous, we're all immigrants at a certain way in Canada. And some of us, some not by their own choice. Their journey is not by their own choice. And we kind of lose touch with that. But, you know, I reflect, part of my reflection about being an immigrant has been, well, actually, my family has only been in the UK, I still have family in the UK, for 3 or 4 generations. They came from Eastern Europe, and they were what we would call refugees today, fleeing persecution, religious persecution. But that should be a very real part of my identity and my understanding of what an immigrant experience is. But we also have to pay attention that the research shows us that lack of confidence in the Canadian immigration system today goes right across our society.
Yeah.
Both people who would not identify as a recent immigrant and people who do recognize as a recent immigrant. One of my staff was telling me recently that they were talking to a local restaurant owner in East Vancouver. Their heavy accent gave away that they were someone who, you know, comes from an immigrant community. And they were saying, it's too many immigrants. You know, and they're hearing that message that various issues in our community is because our population growth or immigration has got carried away. So, you know, on one hand, it's important that I think we all remember our history and our background and our relationship to immigration, because we all have a relationship somewhere to immigration, as I say, unless we're Indigenous. And there's a particular relationship, obviously, to immigration if you're Indigenous as well, just from a different perspective. But we shouldn't take for granted that concerns that are in the community about the state of immigration in Canada are just from people who, you know, long-standing newcomers, been here for many generations. There's concerns right across the community.
I agree. And I think it's actually a good time to kind of go to the next question I was going to ask. And I agree with that. The way I think of it is, I always wonder what went wrong with the narrative. Because, yeah, everyone is complaining about it. I think for me, the part I struggle with is where the blame is going. Because sometimes I always say, you know, and I don't know if this is going to put me in trouble at some point in the future, but I always say the government needs to step up and take some responsibility for everything we're seeing. Because in the end is, we've probably brought in too many people that we've stressed the system. And so everyone's kind of suffering for it. But then what we've done is we've allowed immigrants to be the scapegoat for the issues within the system. So we say, because the way I think of it, and I might be wrong, I might just be talking, I'm ignorant here, is for me it was like, oh, you say we bring in 40 million people. If you plan to bring in 40 million people, then you build a system or you have a plan for how you make sure the society can absorb 40 million people without services becoming an issue, hospital waits growing long, housing becoming a problem, you know, crime going up, you know, just all those things, you know, all those things. And I'm always like, one is, where did the narrative go wrong? And two is, how do we even start to fix that? Because like, there are a ton of people I also know who are immigrants who tell you, oh, we brought in too many people. And I think I agree, we have brought in too many people. But again, is the government is somehow say, okay, maybe we made a mistake here, but that hasn't happened. And like, for me, like, that's the part, like, I don't know, like, nothing. It's just, they've just allowed that narrative to just go on. And it has gotten, the thing with humans is that when you allow us, things just kind of get worse and worse and worse. And it's out of hand now. Like, that's how it feels. Like, it's, the horse has bolted out of the stable and we can't pull it back again.
Well, you raise so many interesting points there. And as you were talking, different pieces of this puzzle kind of flashed into my mind, some of which are here and now, and some of which I think are much more hardwired into human experience and the experience of a country like Canada. First thing that jumped into my mind is that historically and socially, it feels very familiar that when a country is under stress and under pressure, that one of the places that it's easy to turn to is immigrants, right? That's not a new narrative or a new trope, right? I used to work in downtown East Side in Vancouver, and I used to work, our offices of the organization I worked for at that time were outside. There was a plaque commemorating an anti-Chinese, anti-Japanese riot in 1904. It was in Japantown in East Vancouver. So first of all, there's that. Like, this is familiar in modern, not so modern kind of experience of countries.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing that goes through my mind is really needing to critically examine the relationship between some of the critical issues that we face and immigration. And immigration is essentially a factor of population and labor and skills. And so what is the relationship between population growth or decline and things like house prices and, as you said, social infrastructure pressures? And I'm not an expert, I'm not an economist, but when I read about these things and try and inform myself, what I understand is that the relationship is complicated.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, then, though, you raise the point of you know, having to prepare for whatever population we need. And I think that's really critical, because often I think the debate around immigration levels gets framed as we should only have immigration levels that we can support with our infrastructure. And that goes only so far if we understand the population and demographic journey that we're on as a country, which is we have an aging population, and which is higher than the birth rate. And so if we do nothing, we're going to have population decline. Our demographics are going to reduce our workforce and our tax base, and we're going to be in trouble as a country. So to say that we need to have immigration that matches capacity versus capacity that matches our immigration needs is a really critical different way of thinking. And it's like saying the metaphor that I've heard is, or the analogy I've heard is, that if you've got an overcrowded bus route, the solution is not to ban passengers, right? The solution is to increase the capacity of your transit system so that you can get people to their jobs, to their schools, to their communities. And so what do we need in terms of social infrastructure investment? And I was part of a panel recently, and a local mayor was expressing, I can't remember his exact words, but the gist of it was, we can only have the immigration levels that our community can support. And that seemed a very rational, maybe the rational response from a local political leader who's trying to make sure his community is sustainable. But it still strikes me as putting the cart before the horse instead of the horse before the cart. I think we know, and I think economists know, and I think governments know what our population demands are going to be. Now, there's all sorts of policy, how we get that population in the right places with the right skills to meet the needs that we have, how we the mix that we have between temporary residents and permanent residents, and all of this detail. But it's got to start with a sense of clear vision for where we're going in the future as a country, and get back to the point where people understand and recognize the fundamental case for this, right? That, because that is starting to break down. That is starting, we're seeing signals, or have seen signals, that, you know, immigration is just bad for this country. And we have to find ways of limiting it as much as possible, which then gets away from the fact that we have to attract people still. We're not the only place in the world that that needs people and needs highly skilled people. And we have to retain people, right? We can't have newcomers come here with these skills, and we invest and they invest so much time, and then they leave. You know, and one of the things I pointed out on this panel is that some of the highest rates of leavers, of newcomers within, I forget whether it's 5 years or 10 years, are people with doctorates. The most highly educated are the people who are leaving at the highest rates when you look at education level. I mean, that's just one dynamic, one dimension, maybe oversimplified. But the biggest issues are maybe wrapped up in that, around utilizing newcomer skills, making sure that they stay, attracting the right people. Those are maybe in the long term, those may be the biggest challenges that we face in terms of our immigration system, not how we limit people.
Yeah. And thanks for raising that, because I really like that. The analogy is, first of all, it's pretty good. It's like you have the buses full. Just go fix the roads and bring more buses so that more people can. The bus is not full anymore. And I wonder, is if we communicate that, do you think that helps change the narrative? Because it feels like that is not coming through at all, which is, because when you talk to people sometimes, I've been in some interesting conversations. I tend to not call it arguments. Especially with the faceless ones. The faceless conversations are the most interesting ones online. Because then you can't talk. Like, I'll be like, hey, I would love to have coffee with you and have a conversation. They refuse. But every single time when I sit down, I decide to just engage them online and have this conversation. I call back to this point is that you do know that we're actually one of those countries that can afford to even limit immigration. We can actually afford to do so. Because whether we do it or not, there's this report I read by CD Howe Institute, Fast and Slow Canada, which does say that some of our cities are going to die out. Because there's the political pressure of how many people do you even let in? And we need more people to come in, or those cities will die out. And so there's all that conversation around taxing, around we need to build more better clusters of economic corridors because that improves our economic chances. It's just all those conversations, and all those are tied to population. So we need to solve for immigration. Now the question is, how do we do it? How does the government come out and say, yes, we need this amount of people, but this is what we are doing to ensure that the system does not collapse? I think for me, like, part of also my frustration is a very harsh word, but it's just that thing is lacking. There's none of that. This is all we just keep talking about is the number.
Yeah. And as you know, I've been involved in a coalition called the Canada We Believe In.
Yeah.
Which is a very beautiful,
I love that.
Thank you. It's a very small initiative, but it really talks about this notion of a renewed vision for immigration. Again, it's really complicated. I mean, we're coming from a place where there has been broad consensus across our country around immigration. Not unanimous. You know, it was never 100% of people who support immigration, but we've gone down from whatever it was in the 70s to the, less than 50% right now who have confidence. So a significant change. So I think we're going to have to really think carefully about how we construct the narrative and explain to people. And then that's the essential challenge of politics, how to explain complicated issues, not in a patronizing, oversimplistic way, but in an accessible way to people so that they can understand where you're coming from. And it can't be just the government. It can't be just the settlement sector.
Agreed.
I mean, I think one of the places that we're in right now is that some people will look at the settlement sector and look at someone like me and say, well, of course you want to talk about immigration. Your business, your organization benefits from higher immigration levels, you know, so you have a vested interest in it, to which I say, we have a vested interest in instability and successful integration, much more than high numbers. Volatility plays havoc with our business model. It's very hard for us. Anyway, so how do we regain the consensus? I guess part of the theory of the Canada We Believe In was saying that we need to reset some of the high-level principles. We need to construct a clearer vision, which is much more than, as you say, a few numbers, you know, once a year. You know, the number of permanent residents, number of temporary residents.
Yeah.
Why? To what end? And we need to have a greater coalition of people across our society getting behind that. I think there's lots of work that's beginning to happen, which is thinking about how do we create coalition across civil society, business, labor, all sorts of organizations, maybe economic as well as social justice, which talk about the principles of immigration. But I also think that government and civil society and all of those groups need to go back and talk to the public again. And we need to remind the public, we need to remind the public about how important immigration has been is and will be. And we need to humanize it again. And we need to remind everyone that, you know, your wait in the emergency room is not long because of immigrants. In fact, it would be longer if the 20% of registered nurses who are foreign trained were not in the country, right? And so we need to tell people, we need to humanize, we need to tell the stories of immigrants and humanize it again. And we also need to have those discussions with the people who are uncertain. I mean, I rightly or wrongly, I kind of conceive of public opinion around immigration split into three groups. There's folks, I think, who are intuitively supportive. They may want to see changes in policy, but they get the importance of immigration. They understand, they support it. The other end of the spectrum, there's a smaller group who are implacably opposed to immigration for whatever reasons. And that, you know, they will never support the notion of immigration.
Yeah, yeah,
I think
agreed.
Some of those voices are making themselves very apparent in the United States, but there's some of those very, very, very reactionary voices. Nothing we say is going to change their minds.
Yes.
But there's the bigger group in the middle who I think are fundamentally understanding and sympathetic to the importance of immigration and the experience of immigrants.
Yeah.
But they're hearing a lot of arguments that are turning their heads the other direction and thinking, wait a minute, did I get this right? Maybe this is a problem. Maybe there is a bigger connection between some of these problems and immigration. And so we need to go back to those folks, and we don't just lecture to them. You have to, as you said, you know, we have to sit down and talk with people and listen to what their concerns are and try and talk to them. That's a big job, because it's not just in our neighborhoods, it's in our region, it's in our province, in our country. And how do we resource doing that? How do we find the time to do that? And how do we do that in a way that people feel engaged with it? But fundamentally, we're probably at the place where we need to do that in a much more expansive and effective way, because if we don't, well, we only have to look, we have to turn our head southwards to kind of see where we might be heading. That's not a good look.
At all. Oh, gosh. At all.
So we have a responsibility. I think we have a responsibility, those of us who work in the sector. Government has a responsibility. Businesses who rely for their customer base and their staffing base have a responsibility. We all have to come together a bit more on this and have a better dialogue.
Yeah. I think that's that is important. And I don't know how we kind of kick off that conversation. I think part of it is the Canada We Believe In is doing a really good job of that. Which is, I signed up for it. So I engage every now and then. That thing of how do we bring everyone to come and speak and get involved somehow? Because everything, it concerns everyone in different ways. There's something you even said in your remarks, which was basically research shows that the more people know about the facts behind immigration, the less concerned they are. You know?
So there's this sort of cognitive dissonance in the public, which is if you ask people, is there too much immigration? They'll probably say yes. But if you say to people, do immigrants contribute to our communities and to the economy, they also say yes.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, I can't quote you the numbers, but, you know, there is this sense that when we talk in more detail about immigration and we talk about the constituent parts of it and how it fits together into a system, people are much more understanding. Oh, yeah, I understand that we have an aging population. I understand that young people are leaving our small community. I understand that the teachers in my kid's school, the doctor in the local GP practice, you know, the grocery workers are newcomers. And yeah, I know lots of amazing newcomers in my community who I feel like are, you know, integrating and a part of our local community. Yeah, but I keep on hearing that there are too many newcomers. And as you said earlier, you know, I mean, I'm not here to defend any government, and I'm not here to say that every decision has been taken, there's been the right one. I also just think that, you know, when I think back over the last few years, the years of real high growth in particularly temporary residents came right after a pandemic when our world was like turned upside down. So if there was a time where things maybe were overcompensated for and we now need to kind of balance, like it seems like 2022, 2023 are not unexplicable times for that to have happened, because we had this to use the word of the moment, we had this rupture, right? Yeah. With the pandemic. So this notion that we now need to do a bit of course correction. But if the narrative right now is only or predominantly about regaining control, about securing our borders, about protecting our nation, and it's not about, you know, the role that immigrants and newcomers will play in this brave new economic future that we're having to create for ourselves, more independent from the US, you know, as a middle nation, thinking about the world order, about skills, about how money is moving, how jobs are moving, about how talent is moving. If we're not saying that this is an integral part of this economic new future for the country, then we're not doing ourselves justice. And so it's like we've got to do a little bit of, you know, shake our heads and course correct right now, because it's also potential advantage for this country.
Yes.
Right? In terms of talent, in terms of our international standing. You know, I think we have a proud humanitarian track record in this country. We actually do a really great job for the most part of integrating and supporting refugee and humanitarian newcomers. And that is something that is integral to our identity as a country, particularly when you compare it to some of our neighbors and their attitudes to refugees. Yeah. And you know, it's very complicated. We've got lots of benefit. We can control our borders much more easily than, you know, my home country, the UK, can do, which has got its own struggles with immigration. Yeah. So, you know, we can't be too holier than thou about this. But we do understand that people look at Canada in a very positive way. And I was talking to an academic recently, the great Lisa Bruner from UBC, who works for the Center for Migration Studies. And Lisa was saying how until very recently, whenever she would travel to international conferences, people would come up to her and say, wow, what's the secret? How is Canada managing this so brilliantly? And so, you know, we can get back there. We can come back to that place where we're seen as a place that manages immigration well, that balances bringing talent from other countries. We're playing our part in humanitarian efforts. Not that we're not right now, but on that note, you know, I don't think that most Canadians understand the difference between a refugee claimant, an asylum seeker, a government-assisted refugee, a privately sponsored refugee. I don't think people understand that. We need to take time to explain what it means to be a refugee. And, you know, one of our housing workers was saying to me recently, I can remember the exact story, I'm probably not doing it justice, but he was talking to a landlord, and the landlord was saying, well, I don't know, is refugee, are they allowed to be here? Are they legitimate? And the housing workers said, well, this is a government-assisted refugee. They waited years outside of this country. They have been vetted, approved. They've come here, and they have the rights of a permanent resident. And this is the journey they've been through in terms of assessing their refugee status with the UN. And then with, and when they started talking, the landlord's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds great. Right? I mean, we have to take time. We have to take time to explain to people what all of this means. I mean, you know, even those who work in the settlement sector, I mean, I've got people at our organization who've worked in the settlement sector for 30 years, and they ask them a policy question. They're like, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'll have to go and look. I mean, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And so we have to tell these stories. We have to explain the system to people. We have to have a greater sense of literacy in our communities about immigration. And we didn't have to worry about that when this wasn't higher up the worry list. But now we have to worry about it.
Yeah. You know, when you were just talking about this, I was thinking about something I read of recent. I think it was Seth Godin that had summarized it using AI, but it was about a book called Springs of Action, where he talks about the book. I can't say everything about it, but the key thing he was talking about was how words, there are positive words, negative words, and neutral words.
Right.
And more often than not, depending on where someone stands and what they stand to gain from the situation, they will use the word that fits it. And what I kept thinking about when I read that is, how does someone find a way to, let's not say positive words so that people say, oh, you're being overly biased, but even just use neutral words to describe the immigrant conversation. Because it feels like what has happened more often than not is there's people use negative words depending on where they stand, or people use positive words depending on where they stand. And because there's all that back and forth, those folks, I call those folks you put in the middle, the stretch audience, that's they're the ones who... The core audience are the folks who believe in immigration and all that. The stretch audience can either fall into the extreme, or they can fall back into core.
Yep.
Or they can at least stay there and they're not worried. They're just like, oh yeah, I think I understand what it is. For the stretch audience, depending on what's happening in their life, if they're struggling to find jobs, then when someone says to them, oh, you know what? The reason why you can't find a job is because the immigrants have taken all the jobs. It's so easy to believe that, because like, it's just, it's a human thing. And so I was just thinking about that. Like, how do we have more neutral words to describe some of what we are going through? So if that helps for us to have at least a conversation that's a bit sanitized. Because right now it just feels like it's your either seen as, oh, you have a stake to in this, and that's why you're defending it. Or, oh, yeah, you don't. And so, you know, it's, I don't know.
Oh, well, I think it's really, it's a fascinating question. And I'll say one thing, which is, you know, you doing this podcast and having these conversations is part of the solution, you know, and thanks, having different voices. I suppose, this all can get very messy and, you know, big. I guess part of the reflection I have is that in the political reality today, it's very hard to reach that, what did you call them? The stretch middle.
Yeah, the stretch audience.
We communicate in our own moment, circles. You know, when I post something on LinkedIn, most of the people who are reading it are they're the converted. They understand. They may have different perspectives, but they broadly understand. And of course, the social media environment, accentuates the real ends of the spectrum in terms of voices. So you post something, maybe not in LinkedIn, but certainly on X or another platform, you know that you're going to get a reaction from the real vociferous anti crowd. But how do we move in our communities and talk to the people in that stretch middle, right? How do we reach them? They got a lot of things that they're trying to manage in their lives. They're very busy. And how do we have those conversations and how do we reach them and engage and listen and have a dialogue in a meaningful way? And that's something I think that we need to spend, and certainly I and our organization is trying to spend a bit more time thinking about, because that's the group we need to talk to. What I'm encouraged about in some of the conversations I've had recently is that I hear from a real diversity of leaders, not just in our sector, but in across business, education, local government. I hear, and I use the shorthand phrase, a desire for a quote-unquote bigger conversation about immigration. That a sense that we found ourselves in a place where there's this narrative that's been constructed and there's all these policy things, you know, what do we do with a temporary foreign worker program and international students and permanent residents and all of these very particular policy questions are being raised and debated, but it's not fixed and anchored in something bigger. And that's the bigger conversation that we need to have. And I'm hearing that from more and more people. And that encourages me a bit, because I feel like opinion formers and opinion leaders are coming around to the idea that we need to ground these policy decisions in something clearer for people. We can't go from one extreme to the other. We can't go from, you know, talking about immigration in terms of two numbers to making it like you need a PhD to understand it. But there's got to be a middle ground to
say, love that.
You know, these are the broad economic goals for our region and for our country. These are the humanitarian and global affairs goals that we have. This is the population goal. This is, you know, where we want to be at in terms of, you know, having international students contribute to the diversity of our academic institutions and contribute resources, but not be overtaxing. This is the sweet spot for, you know, different immigration groups, and we need to round this out for people so that they understand the context of this.
Yeah. I think one trap I fall into a lot sometimes, and maybe sometimes I pull myself back, but I do fall into it a lot too, is that the idea that things can move so fast. Like, you know, like especially with things like this, like, because immigration is such a big, complex issue.
Yeah.
But you sometimes fall into trouble of thinking of it like it can move as fast as fashion, for example. You know, fashion. But when you reflect on it, you're like, well, this thing sometimes take too long. And humans aren't exactly very patient people. We kind of want it now, especially where we're in pain. Like, it's like, I want you to solve it for me now. And then I'm tempted to ask, and you know, you can say you don't have to answer, but I want to know, when I read the remarks, one of the first things that I was thinking about was, how was it received?
My remarks to the
House of Colors, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure how it was received. There's, you know, the way that the House of Commons select committees work is that witnesses get invited, you can make an opening statement, which I did, 5 minutes, raise a couple of issues. There's usually other witnesses, and then the MPs from the different parties get a few minutes to ask questions, and they can ask questions of whoever they want, and they can ask questions of people who are in the room or who are virtual. I happen to be virtual for this. What is interesting, without sort of taking a partisan position or a policy position, was that in my session, there was an economics professor, I think, from Carleton University, who was there in the room. And he put forward some very specific recommendations around particularly economic immigration levels. And so a lot of the questions went to him. And I think partly it's because, like anything else, once it's a lot easier to talk about specifics than it is necessarily about principles or planning process. But it's also maybe just like a weakness of the notion of talking about how to create a reunion vision. How do we translate that into something more concrete for people? I understand that some of that is quite high level and not grounded in specific policy. So, you know, I think that there is an understanding within sort of political groups, and I'm not talking about just the people on that committee, but generally politicians, again, that we got to find our way out of the current place that we're in right now around immigration. And so I hope my remarks were received reasonably well and in the spirit that they were intended. But we'll have to wait and see, I guess. I mean, I think that one of the pieces that you talk about on speed that occurred to me when you said that, you know, if you're involved in any leadership type role, and obviously my day-to-day work is in leadership of an organization, and ISS of BC, Immigrant Service Society of British Columbia, we're a fairly substantial organization. We have anywhere, depending on different years, 400 to 500 staff. That's quite a complicated ecosystem of people. And, you know, one of the things I've learned over the years, and this is a cliche, but it's so true around leadership, is that, you know, change only moves as fast as the speed of trust. And trust is, it can be, trust earned is a slow and methodical thing born out of people's experiences, not out of people's words.
Gosh.
And that on the other side, trust can be dismantled very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Gosh, right. Like, you can damage trust far quicker than you can build it positively.
Yeah.
And I think we have to recognize that, for whatever reason, whether you agree with this or disagree with it, trust levels in our current government, or let's say the Liberal Party, because there's a different trust level, trust in their running of the immigration system has taken a big hit.
Yeah.
And I think that's a statement of fact, not a partisan statement.
Yeah.
And it's going to be time for them to rebuild that trust. Yeah. But I suppose it's also the trust in the immigration system and the bureaucracy. I don't think there's high trust levels in the Federal Department of Immigration, IRCC. And again, that's not a critical statement. That's a statement, I think, of observation and fact. We work with incredible people at IRCC who are trying to make a system which is very complicated work the best it can. We sometimes agree with what they decisions they make. Sometimes we don't disagree. We don't agree with them, but they're doing the very best that they can. And but trust levels are not high generally in immigration, in political leadership around immigration, in government bureaucratic leadership around immigration. Trust levels are not high. And when you put all of that together, and I would say maybe as well, I point the finger at myself, I'm not sure that in certain quarters, trust levels in immigration organizations is maybe high enough. Some people may look at us and say, oh, well, you know, maybe you're part of the problem. Maybe you're not doing a good enough job in supporting newcomers, or you've advocated for high levels of immigration in the past, and, you know, because it's benefited you.
Yeah.
So trust levels are not high. And it's going to take some time to rebuild those.
Yeah, that it's a brilliant observation. Like, honestly, because it's so true. Like, the trust is easy to destroy. And I feel like we've lost a ton of it across all the levels or all the layers through which immigration is viewed and operated in Canada, there's people like, oh no, I don't believe what you're saying, or there's something going on somewhere that I don't believe in. I don't know. It's
But I think it's also, as I hear you, you know, as I hear myself speak back to you and I listen to that, I also think it's really important that we recognize that trust is not fundamentally broken. It's decreased, right? And it's at levels that are lower than we've seen historically.
Yeah.
I think the message is, and some data has said that it stabilized in the last year. It came down the sort of confidence.
Yeah, I heard it's kind of going up again to some extent.
So I think I don't know if it's going up or at least it's stabilizing. But I think we just have to be cautious that we can't afford another drop off. And I don't know what might cause that. But we have to make sure that if there is a leveling off, if there is a bit of stability, that is the start of an upward trend again, not a new plateau, which then at a certain point we will drop off again. We can't, we have to address that. So I think it's really important. I really worry as well when we talk about any public or social system and we describe it as broken, right? I hear that a lot. I grew up in the UK, and for as long as it's been operating, people would describe the British healthcare system, the NHS, as broken, right? And we talk about our healthcare system sometimes here as broken, or immigration system as broken. Look, every day, our team at ISS at BC and teams at other immigration organizations are helping people settle, find homes, find jobs, learn languages, learn skills, become integrated, build networks, feel a sense of belonging. We're doing that work and we have success every day. There are parts of our system that are under strain, that are not working as well as they need to, that need to improve, but that doesn't equal broken. Broken is a pejorative word that means that something is ruptured. It's literally in two pieces, right? It's broken apart. We are not broken apart. We're in need of always improving, and certainly our sector has got to continuously look at how we support people. But I just don't buy into, and I just want to avoid the language of being broken.
Yeah, kind of goes back to what I said about I always tell people these days that when someone says something to me, I always go like, they are really, it's more about themselves than that thing. Because when people use the word broken, it's really how they want, the bias which they want to use to view that. I mean, bias is a bit harsh, but just it's that, you know, and which is why I'm like, I really want to find one. I'll say to my wife some days ago, I want to do a project where I say, can I find more neutral words to describe a ton of the immigrant issues that we have, and say, because if you, in the end, really is broken or failed or working and stuff like that, it just depends on where you want to see it. But it's not that, like you said, the trust has dropped. It's a very different conversation. It's reduced because people don't believe. Some people don't. Some people do. Some people are worried. And so there's a variant somewhere. But that nuance, no. We just want to just either it's working or it's not working.
Yeah.
And like, you're right to say, if you look at every system, and if you talk to someone who moved here to Canada 50 years ago, someone who moved 20 years ago, someone 10 years ago, they can flag issues. That doesn't mean the system is broken. It just simply means that the system has issues and is tackling them every single time, as every system does. Like, you know, I want to ask this, which is, and folks, I'm not going to call out the principles. You all go, I want you to go visit the We Believe in Canada site, the Canada We Believe in website. But you all have like 5 core principles. If you could pick one that could be addressed first, what would that be?
Scanning through them in my brain. it sounds quite managerial and practical, but I think the last of them is really critical. Well, there's two of them in combination. One is that we have to have clear strategic goals for immigration as a country. We have to ground what we're doing in something more than just a percentage of population. And also really critical is that we need to have a really, truly whole of government, whole of society approach to talking about the future of immigration. Those are, for me, critical components that we have to get right to firm up again this foundation, mm-hmm. to build trust. Those are the critical pieces for me. So I'm sorry, I picked two.
I wanted them to go read the rest. Kind of following on that, and it's kind of linked to what you just said now. There's something you said, I think, in your remarks, where you talked about we shouldn't measure success anymore by, total arrivals and population rates. You know, like, and so how should we measure it? Like, because it feels like those are much easier numbers. It's similar to what you described about the folks where at the House of Commons, economics was easy to talk about because that you can hold on to. Oh, GDP went up. It's so easy to measure. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the ones that we should measure? Like, all right.
Well, I think that's the conversation that we need to hear, to talk about. I mean, I think, I would love to sit down with economists and local politicians and, people from across civil society and talk about that in a similar way that we're slowly realizing that gross domestic product, GDP, is not the be all and end all of a country's, wealth. We need to talk about immigration in terms of our population goals, and our demographics. We need to talk about it in terms of our skills gaps. We need to talk about it in terms of investment that's brought in to this country through newcomers, whether they're international students or entrepreneurs. We need to talk about it in terms of the global brand of our country, which is partly to do with all of our streams of immigration, but partly to do with our humanitarian work. We need to have a conversation about what some of those measures are. Those are some of them that come to mind for me. We need to talk about those at a national level, a regional level, local level, so that people understand how is immigration supporting where I live as well as our country. How is it bolstering our position in the world globally? How is this supporting the sustainability of my community as well as, the economic future of my province or my country? We need to have some different ways of talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, again, like I think I said this in the preach before we started recording, I think probably the why I say I don't have the answers, but I think why it's a good thing is, I feel like, I mean, it depends on how we treat it, but it's a crisis, and probably if we see it that way, then we can find the good in it, which is basically like, it kind of forces us to have these conversations, which I think is good for the country. If that, for me, I think that's the good thing for me. Like, it's uncomfortable, but they are great. We need to start asking these kind of questions, because these questions, I see questions as open doorways. That's what I call questions. Like, once they're just doors. You open them and you go in there. You don't know what you're going to find, but hopefully it's a good thing. So I think for me, like, that's the good part about this all is, yes, it's hard. There's a ton of things that have happened that are not great, but really, I think it's good.
And that's the opportunity we face right now, that there are more conversations taking place, right, in different venues around immigration. And that is that's an opportunity. That's a great opportunity for us as a sector, as a community, as a country.
Yeah. One last question before we get to the book of questions. And if Canada gets this right over the next 10 years, what do you think it'll look like? And if we don't, what do we lose that we could never get back?
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, we know what the prize is. The prize is an economy an economy that's supported well through immigration, through the newcomers and their skills and their diversity of worldviews in a globalized economy. We have the skills we need as a country. We have, you know, a population strategy that is at least going to avoid the worst outcomes. We're going to have communities that feel that they are strong and diverse and sustainable. And we're going to have an international reputation that continues to be that we are a positive and principled and valued part of the international community. All of those things which we've had and we still have to a certain extent, but those will be strengthened through a strong immigration system which people have confidence in. What happens if we get it wrong, if we go from that plateau we talked about and it drops off again? Well, you know, we could just find that we're in this place that we're in right now where it's just it continues to be a very partisan, a very divisive issue that we don't really find consensus, but we just keep muddling through.
Yeah.
You know.
Gosh, no, please. No,
I don't really want to even consider the alternatives are even worse than that, because we see those in different parts of the world, and we don't want to go there.
It feels like we can't even afford to go there. Like we can't even afford to go there.
Well, I think that would signify something much greater about Canadian values and culture and identity. It won't just be about immigration at that point. It'll be about something far greater. So we have to recognize that immigration right now and multiculturalism and diversity in our communities is integral to that discussion that we're having right now around Canadian identity and Canadian uniqueness, what makes Canada Canada and not, you know, a subdivision of another country. It's part of it. We have to get this right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that. And now we're at the end. So it's called the book of questions. You got to pick a number between 1 and 291.
107.
Interesting choice. interesting choice, really. While arguing with you on the phone, a close friend gets angry and hangs up. If he or she does not call back, would you call them? If so, how long would you wait?
Absolutely, I call them. I don't love conflict. And I love my best friends. And if we got to the point where we're hanging up on each other, I think we'd probably both be calling each other ourselves at the same time. I think, you know, when I think about it in terms of my personal life or my professional life, I probably make mistakes every single day. And I do try and rectify those. I try and follow up. I had a meeting yesterday where I just had this sixth sense that one of our team left and maybe there was something there that they didn't feel comfortable about. And I sent them a message within an hour. Well, was it within an hour? Fairly soon. So if that's a common thing, I don't sit on these things. I like to follow up. But maybe that's just, I don't like conflict. Who does? I don't know. Some people do, I guess. Some people do. I don't love conflict. So no, I call right away.
I think what I love also about how you started was that you used the word love. I really want more people to get comfortable saying, I love my friends. Like I say that to my, like, I love you because I feel like we live in a world where we've kind of divorced from that. And we now feel conflict is normal. Like we shouldn't have all that. Like if you have a close friend, like you really, they really matter to you. So exactly. I love that you use that word, that word. But yeah, thank you so much. Like, thank you. This was, I knew it was going to be good. I knew it was going to be really, really good.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Thursday. I really appreciate it. It's great. Carry on with these, with this podcast and with all your work. It's a great voice that you add to the landscape. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That's it, everyone. That's always where you can find us with this. This will go on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, everywhere you get your podcast, you'll find that there. Thank you so much.